Good morning, everyone. We'll go ahead and get started. I know we're about 30 seconds early or so, but maybe we'll end a few seconds early to get you guys over. I wanted to show you just quickly the image here, and I played around with it. You can see with the filters, maybe not to the best. I could have probably done a little bit better. But this is the statue in front of Concord, which is just outside of Lexington. We talked, of course, about what happened at Lexington. And in this image, which I, again, stylized way too much, if you could actually see it, you would notice that this is a man about your age. And you can see that he's got one hand. He has his right hand holding his musket, but he has his left hand behind him holding his plow, showing that he's rooted in the agricultural Republican tradition, but he's also willing to fight when absolutely necessary. So this is hardcore, this is the essence of Republicanism, the idea that you would be willing to lay down whatever is most important for you, meaning your life, for those things which are equally important, your family, your faith, your home, your country. And that's what a Republican is. So that image of the patriot there, the Minuteman, and of course being ready within a minute's notice, this is really the essence of what it means to be an American in this time period. Okay, that's all I wanted to show you. And since I blanked out, which I don't know why, that's okay. So I want to continue just a little bit with what we were talking about with the idea of a republic and with our discussion of Cato and who Cato is, what Cato was, and what he meant to us as Americans. So I'm going to throw out two ideas right now, and then we're going to look at the document itself. But two additional things that you have to know about the nature of a republic and what a republic is. So number one, we've already talked about what goes into republicanism, and we've talked about the four ideas about what allows a republic to succeed. But we also have to remember that a republic is always natural. It's a reflection of our own existence, of our own human creativity, and our own human design. Meaning that when you look to a republic, the reason that you have the three branches, and this is how Plato and Aristotle had first put it way back around the 4th century BC, that in its natural state, a republic will always reflect the three elements, or what we might call the three faculties of knowing in a human person. Get that off. So the three faculties of knowing. And those three faculties, as understood by Plato and then Aristotle, and later by Cicero and other figures, those three faculties are broken down into the three parts of the upper body. So we have the mind, which is the center of rationality, as our highest, the head, and therefore, I hope this is all clear, it should be obvious, this is the representation of the executive branch, where the executive branch is actually a representation of that. And then our lowest faculty are our passions. Hunger, desire, cravings, instinct, our passions come into this. These are always associated with the stomach or even the regions, the procreative regions slightly below. So the passions in the stomach, this is the most animalistic thing, and it's the thing we share with all the animals. And this would be related to the demos or the democracy. So the highest thing is rationality, at least in terms of where it is in our body. Reason up there as well, a modern form of reason. And then the lowest are passions. But what makes us most human, ironically, is not either of these things. We have to be able to bridge these things. So if we're purely rational, and please, you know, think about too how we were talking about this with various enlightenments. This fits perfectly with the Scottish Enlightenment. But if we were purely rational, we would constantly be walking around making calculations. I choose this over this. This thing is better than this. I've weighed the costs and I've weighed the benefits. And what we would become if we did that, we would be nothing more than a machine. We'd be a thinking machine, a walking, talking machine. Because our decisions, there's not a lot of free will. You just make the decision based on this or that and you choose whatever is better for you. Now, we all do that. Every one of us does that. As we joked about with Yeah, the reason I go to Costco and the reason that I buy stuff like this, which costs by individual unit about 20 cents, but that means you have to buy like the 1 million pack box in order to get the 20 cents discount. I calculated that's a lot cheaper than going to Walmart, if I don't even know if Walmart carries that, but let's imagine they do. So it's worth for me going up to Ann Arbor to Costco, buying it and coming home. It's worth the gas, it's worth the time, everything because of the price difference. I'm calculating. But I don't do that when I'm talking to you. I don't calculate. I don't think, oh, Abby's worth, is it about 80? And Judy's worth, is it about 27? So therefore, yeah, I don't do that. I mean, it would be horrible if I did that. I don't calculate based on that. It would be inhumane to do that. It would be wretched. I could do it. I have the ability to do it, but I wouldn't. In the same way that there's probably, and I would be stunned if any one of you, is there anyone in this room who thinks we should bring back slavery? We just don't. And it's not just because we're in 2017. We as a humanity, and it's not everywhere, slavery still exists, obviously. It's probably worse now than it's been since the 19th century. But we believe very strongly it's not proper to use another person in that way. And yet we do. And I don't want to be too moralistic here about this, but imagine that every time you go to the grocery store, doesn't matter if you're going to a nice grocery store or a low-class one, you're going to, when you walk through the cashier, the checkout line, you're going to see magazines of all kinds of people who did what to their bodies, who got divorced. We do objectify people, and it is a form of slavery in the way that we don't give them full credit for who and what they are. So I don't want to suggest this is gone. We can use this, like all things, either for good or for evil. Same thing is true here, and passions, especially at a place like Hillsdale, where, you know, obviously many of us have let our passions go. It's why we have the population rate we have in this little town. You know, you have a provost who has 11 kids. That's a lot of passion. And I guarantee you, they were not sitting around calculating cost-benefit, do we want child number 11 or not? Yeah, let's go for it. Yeah, that's not how it works. So you have to have the passion there too. But imagine if we were only based on that. Well, then we'd be no better than the animals. So we can't be machines and we can't be animals. And this means that for the ancients, as well as for the founders, the most important faculty is the via media, that is the thing that is in between. And the via media for us is our heart or our soul. And this faculty is almost always associated with what we would call reason or imagination, the ability to see beyond, so that when I approach you, I don't just see a 18, 19-year-old amber-haired woman, I actually see a human person. Doesn't look like me, and yet we have obviously everything in common, and yet we have nothing in common. We share a common humanity, but we don't share age, we don't share skin type, nothing else. But we definitely share our humanity. And it's the imagination that allows me to see beyond simply what is the appearance and define the reality. That's what the soul does. And so the irony of this is the things that are absolutely calculable and knowable, what is rational and what is passionate, these things, if taken to extremes, make us least human. The thing that makes us most human is that which comes from outside of us. That is our ability to see beyond ourselves. It's one of the great paradoxes of the liberal arts, that we liberate ourselves from the things of this world, but by doing so, we actually free ourselves to become more human. It's the great paradox. So this is associated, very importantly, I didn't have room there, obviously, but this is associated with, in our government, the Supreme Court, and the Senate. So this is why you have 6 years in the Senate. You don't have to worry about the constant rotation. You don't have to worry that whatever the passion of the moment is going to kick you out of office. You can give it another 5 years or 4 years or whatever time you have left to let things play out. And you've all seen in your own lives how often attitudes can change. And what we firmly believe, looking at social media, for example, today, is not what we believed 2 weeks ago. And passions can be very high, and we can get emotional. And we take something like the tragic death of somebody, and we exaggerate it. yet we make it a symbol for so many greater things. And it's a tragedy in and of itself, of course, but then we make it something broader. And that's natural. We should react. There's nothing wrong with being attracted to somebody. There's absolutely nothing wrong with wanting something. But it's how far you're willing to go and what you're willing to compromise to make it happen. That's where you get the danger. So Thomas Aquinas, one of my favorite thinkers, would say something to the extent that there's nothing wrong with getting angry. Angry is God's way of telling you there's an injustice. It's totally fine. But if in your anger you go out and smash somebody to bits, well, you've kind of taken it too far. So this, in the same way, simply because you find somebody desirable because you're attracted to them, you still have to have their permission and their desire equally for there to be some kind of coupling. So these are all choices that can be made, but there also has to be this medium in between these things. So the three faculties of a republic are essential. You can't have a unified republic. If a republic is unified, something has failed. A republic, by its very nature, has to be decentralized. Now, just imagine this for a moment. Look at this. What's the problem with this, besides the fact, let's assume that my handwriting's okay and you can actually discern what I'm trying to tell you. But regardless, what's the problem with this? And what is it we complain about? We still complain about all the time. Yeah, it takes forever. Right? Nothing happens quickly in a republic, and when it does, you should be very uncertain. Things should not work very quickly. And so this is incredibly complicated, and it's meant to be that. Just like humanity is incredibly complicated. How great would it be if I could fit any one of you into an equation and predict everything? Right? That would make my life so much easier. But I can't do that. I can't do that to you. I can't do that to my kids. I can't do that to my wife. I can't do that to my best friend. I can predict certain things. But free will means, in essence, that you must always have faith things will work out when you have no knowledge. They will. If you believe in free will, it means you don't know what's going to happen an hour from now. Anything can happen. If you don't believe in free will, life gets a lot simpler. But free will complicates everything. And so this idea here of, well, how do we choose? What do we do? Well, we have to have reliance that each of these branches and each member of these branches is actually willing to set aside personal differences, anger, emotion, to get things done, which we know doesn't happen. We have pout fits where people, now Indiana's about to pass a law, so one party all goes and stays in a hotel in Illinois so they can't have a functioning chamber. We see that all the time. We see people right now not showing up for hearings in D.C. because they don't want to be there so a vote can be taken. This is incredibly childish, but it's also very human. So these are reactions. We have to be willing at some level to get beyond this. So the problem, and this is point number two, the problem with this is because a republic is natural, because it's organic, it has a life, it also has a death. So you cannot be a Republican. That is a small r. You cannot believe in a republic unless you know your government is temporary. And that's a blow. We're not Hitler. We're not creating a 1,000-year Reich. When you create a republic, you automatically are admitting defeat in the future. The goal is to get there as slowly as possible. But you create a republic knowing it will die in the same way that my mom, when she gave birth to me, unless she was just a fool, and she's not, she's brilliant, but she knows that at some point my son will become middle-aged and he will die, just as she will. And that's, we all do that. We know that. We don't necessarily like to think about our death, but it has to be there. So if we have a thing that is natural, a government that is natural, very complicated, it too must go through a life cycle. It has to have a birth, it has to have a middle age, whatever that middle age may be, and it will die. And that's just the fact of things. So what you want to do as Republicans, knowing, so you can never, George Washington can't, John Adams, John Dickinson, Thomas Jefferson, these guys cannot walk into Congress or the Constitutional Convention believing what they're creating is permanent. They cannot do that. If they've done that, they've already failed. So part of your success is knowing that you will not ultimately be successful. You have to plan for this when you create a republic, that it will have a life cycle. The goal then is to make sure that this part right here between birth and middle age is as good as possible. So you want it to last as long as possible. You want your youth, you want your energy, and you want your health. And the only way to preserve that, or I should say the best way to preserve that, is through having a good soul. So your body must be in good shape, but it must be protecting a good soul as well. So you have to have a spirit of a people, not just a body. So we could have the best constitution in the world, but if we don't care about it, it means absolutely nothing. The constitution can only work if it's based on our desire to make it work. And again, the image I put up of the young patriot, the Minuteman, being willing to lay down your life at a lot of different levels, maybe literally, maybe just for moments, maybe giving up your treasure, whatever it may be, you have to be willing to contribute that. But there's always a cycle. So the cycle of life, as we see in a republic, is this. It's always cyclical, and yet it can start over again. And it's not inevitable that the death has to be tomorrow. Maybe we can actually re-energize things and prolong our life for another 100 years. Maybe we can do it for another 20 years. I think, frankly, in our lifetime, and we'll talk about this later in the semester, I think someone like Ronald Reagan, who would have been totally unpredictable on the world scene, combined with John Paul II, combined with Alexander Solzhenitsyn, all at the same moment in history, I think they probably gave us 20 years of breathing room. Now, what we did with that may be very questionable, but I think they gave us that. And now we've gone past that. We're trying to figure out a world after what we've blown. And that's where you're at. I feel terrible for you guys if that's the world you're entering. But it's a much deadlier world than it was when I graduated from college in 1990. It's a much deadlier world now than it was then. So we're in these stages, and it's never perfect. The Senate may be here, the presidency may be here, the House may be here, Brad may be here, your mom may be here. I mean, it doesn't matter. It's always very complicated. It's not that we can just say, okay, the Republic started, then it died, or it hit middle age, and now it's about to die. We don't know. If you can actually ascertain that, you're probably not in the Republic at all. It's very difficult to be able to abstract yourself enough. So think about this. Think about Cato. What happens with Cato? Who's the loss in the story that you guys read? And we don't even know that much about it. But who really loses? I mean, we see Cato at his end. The whole play is about Cato at his end. So there's his death is inevitable, and yet he becomes immortal through his death. So who dies?
Well, Cato dies, but the people who really lose are the Romans.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? The people have lost. The whole Roman soul is gone. Cato was essentially the soul for Rome. And so with his death, even though he can go to Valhalla, or he can go to the gods, or heaven, or purgatory, Dante's right. Now, whatever happens to him, he's the soul. He represents the soul of the Roman people. So the Romans live, their body remains, but they're decadent. They have their vomitoriums, they have their orgies, they have their imperialism. They're totally decadent. They've lost it. So, but what remains? Think about what remains, even if the soul is gone and the body is corrupt. Cato remains, even though he's dead, the image of Cato, the symbol of Cato. We can remember him. So this is why, and you think, how many of you have, in great books, read the Aeneid? Okay, enough of you, good. The story of the Aeneid is the story of George Washington. Washington, think about Aeneas. He's the great protector of Troy. Troy is taken from him by untoward means because the Greeks are too wimpy to confront them and head-on battle, so they sneak in. And when they sneak in, they hit the heart of the Trojans. They kill the women and children, and they leave the men in total disarray. And then for many years, Aeneas and his survivors, they have to look for some place, and they mess up. They go to North Africa, and of course, poor Dido. It's horrible. Dido's my favorite tragic figure in all of history. Yeah, despite the fact she becomes a witch and a Satanist, you kind of feel sorry for her. Like, yeah, she was really jaded, and she was really jilted by Aeneas. She's a pretty interesting figure. But regardless, Aeneas and his men go on, and then they arrive on the Tiber. And when they get there, they find the Latins are already there. And what do? They battle with the Latins. And yet they have to work out how to become one, so the Trojans and Latins become one, and that's the birth of Rome. And that's no different than English colonists landing, battling with the American Indians, and having to become one. And Washington saw himself very much as an Aeneas figure. If you can't have the truth in Troy, you can try it in North Africa. If it doesn't work there, you try it on the Tiber. If it doesn't work there, you go to the Thames. If it doesn't work there, you go to the Hudson, or you go to the Delaware, or you go to the St. Joe River in Hillsdale. You just keep moving. You keep replanting your truth over and over again. So even though Cato is dead, the image remains. And it may take 2,000 years for him to be remembered properly, but he's there. And we only have to remember him for that to come back again. So the Americans see themselves very much as replanting ancient truths on modern soil. That's what they're trying to do. So does that make sense for everyone? How they see themselves? And so they also, again, you know, think about this. We didn't talk much about it, but at the very beginning of the Declaration, when in the course of human events, that's not just some rhetorical flourish. That's the cycle of life. When in the course of human events, it becomes the duty of one people to dissolve its bands and create another, it must announce to the world what it's doing. It's Cato. Cato's done what he's done. He's dead. We're going to try and revive his spirit. We need to let everybody know why. It's a remembering. It's bringing things back. In the ancient world, this would have been called an anamnesis. That is, to bring back that which is true, or to remember that which is true. And the entire revolution is an anamnesis of truth. And I think I can say that fairly objectively. Obviously, I'm coming from a very patriotic perspective. But I think it's still, most people in the world would agree, at least at some point or another, that what we do in terms of America is also in many ways a reflection of the ancient world. So there's a reason that when we go to Washington, D.C., and we look at the original buildings, that they do not look as though they were built on Babylonian architecture or on Botswanan architecture or even English architecture. There's a reason the Capitol is built like a third century Roman Republican building, because that's who they are. They are Roman Republicans as they're reestablishing this. So if you had your Cato, I just want to open up for a moment to the very last thing that we have with his desire for some kind of immortality of the soul. And so I want to turn, if you have the book, or if you have the PDF, I'd like to turn to page 88, and this is Act 5, Scene 1, where we have Cato trying to, he bleeds out, but I did look up in Plutarch. I didn't know this, I had to look this up, but Plutarch says that yes, indeed, Cato bled out for a very, very long time. Now, what Plutarch knows that definitely, or it was just the idea of the time. I had always assumed it was something Addison was making up, but it looks like that was the ancient tradition. Sorry, I thought I had printed it out. I've got it somewhere. But anyway, Cato is supposedly, this is true. But if you look there on page 88 of the play, right at the top of Act 5, Scene 1, we have Cato sitting in a thoughtful posture, and in his book, is Plato's book on the immortality of the soul, and of course he has a drawn sword, as it says on his table. And the book, by the way, does it say this? It's the Phaedo. The footnote, at least, for those who have the same copy, it's the Phaedo. It must be so, Plato. Thou reasonest well. Else whence this pleasing hope, this fond desire, this longing after immortality? Or whence this dread secret and inward horror of falling into naught? Why shrinks the soul back on herself and startles at destruction? 'Tis the divinity that stirs within us. 'Tis heaven itself that points out and hereafter, and intimates eternity to man. Eternity, that pleasing, dreadful thought, though what variety of untried being, and so forth. And that, I think, is really important, because the only hope this pagan can have is that another pagan, Plato, got it right, and that somehow his desire to live on is not ego, but it's God calling to him and saying, Cato, be mine. You have done well with your virtue. Now come and live in eternity. And so his longing there, at least in my theology that I grew up in, we would call a desire of baptism, even though it's not an actual baptism. There is something in that desire that we know, of course, it can't be man's will, it has to be God's grace, but God may recognize that. And if you guys, any of you have read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and the Narnia series, of course, that's exactly what happens in number 7, and the last battle with the young man, who, of course, is supposed to be Islamic, though they don't say that, and God transfers his allegiance from one to another and accepts it, knowing that this was a desirous thing. Pretty amazing moment, whatever you think of the theology involved. But as he says, my soul will take flight, and may it rest in the hands of the Almighty. So, again, he's a pagan. There's no way. I mean, he dies 50 years before Christ is even conceived. So, obviously, he can't be a Christian, but there is that longing. And yet his desire, and you can see this throughout the end here, and it's a gut-wrenching desire, his desire is both to remain master of himself in this world, but to give himself over to the master of the next world. And he's having a very difficult time, as we all would. He's having a very difficult time balancing those things. You know, what do I do where I can brag about my life, which I'm not supposed to brag, but is it good enough that God will accept me, or is he going to accept my apology? I mean, how's this going to work? And he's pretty confused about that, but he only has hope, nothing more. He has hope and a little bit of faith, but mostly hope that something will work out. Okay, so did any of you have, I know you've got your papers due on Friday, so, and I'd like a hard copy, by the way, I don't know if I told you that, and just throw it under my door up at my office. The office closes at 6 on Friday, and I won't actually check things until probably Sunday night or so. So anyway, just make sure that you throw the paper under my door by 6 o'clock on Friday. So anybody have questions or thoughts as you're getting ready? I hope the discussion we had at least kind of gives you a sense. Yeah, tell me your name again in the back.
Christopher.
Thank you.
Is it supposed to be on Cato specifically or just anything?
Well, I'd like it to be based around the play that you have, but you can do anything you want with the play. If you want to talk about virtue or a character, if you want to draw it into the American Revolution, that's totally fine. But yeah, I'd like it to be rooted in the play itself, but you can take it any direction you want from there. So, yeah. And your name again?
Rebecca.
Thanks.
How do you want us to cite this?
If you're only citing this, you don't need to. Just put like page number or something after a quote. You don't need a footnote or anything like that. I mean, if you go into a source beyond this, then it would be good to distinguish. So maybe AHR for American Heritage Reader versus, say, Cato.
Okay.
So, but don't get complicated about it at all. No research is needed, just simplest citations possible. It's good. Okay, yeah.
And if we're not using a direct quote, we just don't like a parenthetical citation as to like where we came.
No, only if it's a direct quote.
Okay.
It's fine. Yeah, I'm not gunning for plagiarism charges or anything. I'm going to assume that you're not going to do that, and just, yeah, you'll be fine. Just make sure I know. If you quote something, then it needs to be cited, but very simply. Even if it's just, again, if it's one book, if you're only using Cato, just put parentheses page number after the quote. You don't even have to say it's Cato. So, okay, good. Anything else? Substantive or dealing with the topic? Okay, good. Well, let's finish up today by looking at another Republican document. And I think in many ways, more Republican than even the Declaration, partially because the Declaration is the beginning. And this document, the Northwest Ordinance, I'd like to look at, is in so many ways an answer to that beginning with the Declaration. So the Northwest Ordinance, and think about the time period happening here, right? Think about the great documents. So United States Continental Congress, first one, meets in September of 74. We have the first Continental Congress. Then we have the first battle, April of 75 at Lexington. That's the beginning of fighting. Independence is not declared until July 2nd of 1776. And by the time Congress declares independence, there had already been close to 200 declarations of independence passed by states and localities. So they're everything from Classroom 125 has seceded from Britain to your local, and I'm not exaggerating, to your local Presbyterian church has seceded from Britain. So one of the things we know about Congress is they're behind. And they have to act very, very quickly, and the Declaration very quickly, because they're trying to make sure this independence movement doesn't get out of hand. They need to give it voice. So on July 2nd, of 76, Congress declares independence. They draft then the declaration 2 days later, but the declaration, actually, even though we celebrate it on July 4th, it's not signed until August 2nd of 76. So this is our real, that if we want to talk about the declaration, essentially, that's where it comes from. Not July 4th, but August 2nd, when it's signed. And then we go into a situation in which we're not quite sure how to govern ourselves. It's really hard. It's great to talk about governance in theory, but then to make it work is very, very difficult. And so John Dickinson, one of the greatest and sadly one of the most forgotten of the founding fathers, writes our first constitution called the Articles of Confederation. And frankly, they're not bad. I think because in a place like Hillsdale, where obviously we revere the Constitution, our U.S. Constitution, the articles are pretty good. There weren't a lot of problems under them. There were some, and we'll talk about that as we get into the Constitutional Convention. But we basically went from one very good constitution to an excellent constitution. So we often, I think, as Americans, we like to downplay the significance of the articles. But imagine, we defeated the largest empire in the world under the articles. We didn't do that under the Constitution. We did it under the articles. And so the articles go into effect roughly around 1777, and they are our government all the way up until 1789. And even to this day, we'll get into this later as we look at these documents, but even to this day, meaning right now in February of 2017, there are parts of the articles we don't know if they've actually been abolished or not. So, for example, if you've ever read through the articles, there is a point, I think it's either point 11 or 13, I have to look, that says at any moment, Canada, without vote, can join the United States. And because the Constitution does not deal with that issue explicitly, it's not clear that that provision is now no longer constitutional. So none of you would remember this. This all happened about the time you were born. But right in the late 90s, Quebec was trying to secede, and they came within just a few votes of seceding from the rest of Canada. And it was an open debate. Well, what's going to happen if you're British Columbia or you're Saskatchewan or Alberta? What are you going to do? And it was pretty likely thinking they would just join the United States at that point. They would not, Alberta could not go out on its own. British Columbia could, but Alberta just couldn't. But it could join in. What do we do? If it actually is, if that article is still in effect, I think that's fascinating. So I'm not saying this is going to happen. There are always these possibilities. So the articles are regarded, and we'll get into this a little bit later, so you don't write it down. No, it's no big deal. But the articles are always regarded as the second document of what are called the four organic documents in history. And they have been given, typically in history, they have been given constitutional weight. Even though the Constitution supersedes it, they have very, very high power. So that's one. Declaration is one of is the first of the organic documents. Articles are number two, but number three, not the Constitution. Constitution is number four. Number three is what I want to talk about, and that is the Northwest Ordinance. That is the third of the organic, four organic documents that supposedly make up our constitutional framework. Not just the Constitution, but the Declaration, the Articles, the Northwest Ordinance, and then the Constitution. The Northwest Ordinance is originally written by Thomas Jefferson. And it is written for Virginia. That is, as Virginia is thinking about expanding into the West, this is a rule for how to define what westward expansion will mean. Virginia rejects it. So Thomas Jefferson then gives it to a congressman from New England by the name of Nathan Dane. Nathan Dane modifies it a little bit, and he introduces it into Congress in July of 1787. And on July 13th, one of the few dates you absolutely have to know in this class, on July 13th of 1787, the Northwest Ordinance is passed unanimously. Not a dissenting vote in Congress. It is passed unanimously. And it becomes, for all intents and purposes, it becomes the mission statement of what the American frontier, bless you, of what the American frontier will mean, what its significance is to the American people. And everything from this college which was founded under the auspices of the Northwest Ordinance, and our articles of incorporation here at Hillsdale are all based on what we believe to be the truths of the Northwest Ordinance. To the first historian here, Ransom Dunn, who in 1854 goes up to Jackson, Michigan and founds the Republican Party. This was all part of an emanation of the Northwest Ordinance. So even the very name Republican of the Republican Party, which still exists, but institutionally is founded in 1854, all goes back. Why do they call themselves Republican? Because they're taking their name from this document, the Northwest Ordinance. Not from the Declaration, not from the Constitution, but from the Northwest Ordinance. So the Republican Party's existence is only there because it believes it's living out document number 3 of the 4 organic articles, of the 4 organic documents, and that is the Northwest Ordinance. So let's turn to this and what specifically Dane presents before Congress and what Congress unanimously accepts after Jefferson authored the essence of it. So you guys all remember, July 13th. This is one of those, my grandparents would have had to have memorized these 6 articles of the Northwest Ordinance to graduate high school. I did not. And so my generation was probably the first not to have to do that. I'm guessing none of you had to do that for your high school education, but it's still really important. So we'll look on page 141 there. And the first part's fine. It's just a description. Here's what we're trying to do. It's the articles that matter most. So again, I can't stress this enough. Passed unanimously. It is also the very first act that the U.S. Congress under the U.S. Constitution passes. So they reaffirm it as a constitutional law. So not just under the Articles, but under the U.S. Constitution. And it is the basis for the foundation of the Republican Party in 1854. So a critical document. We could never have a Lincoln without this. Lincoln is the embodiment of the Northwest Ordinance. Article the First. No person demeaning himself in a peaceable and orderly manner shall ever be molested on account of his mode of worship or religious sentiments in the said territory. Now think how different that is from what we just read 3 weeks ago with what it was like to be a Baptist in Connecticut or a Baptist in Virginia, where you just had a snot beaten out of you for being that, right? Or worse. So we go from a situation, just in our 3 weeks' time in class, 4 weeks, we go to a situation for almost complete religious intolerance to exactly the opposite. You can do whatever you want. You can even be an atheist. Just don't bother anyone else. It's incredible to go just in a very short time period from absolute religious intolerance to complete toleration. Article the Second, and we don't have to read the whole thing, but the beginning and the end of this. The inhabitants of the said territory shall always be entitled to the benefits of a writ of habeas corpus and a trial by jury, of a proportionate representation of the people in the legislature, and of judicial proceedings according to the course of the common law. So our law is not man-made. Our law is discovered, and it's at least 1,500 years old by the time we arrive in Ohio. So the common law is absolute. It is the law of the people. And all of those rights that go with common law, they all, it doesn't matter if you step across the Ohio River, you have them, because you're human. And they will be guaranteed and enforced here. So all common law. But then look at the end, and my libertarian soul rejoices at this part. Very much so. If you look at the end of the last 4 lines of that, and in the just preservation of rights and property, it is understood and declared that no law ought ever be made, ever, and there are no exceptions, ever be made, or have force in said territory that shall in any manner whatsoever interfere with or affect private contracts or engagements unless fraud has been detected. So, if I make an agreement with one of you, and whatever that agreement is, maybe we're going to start a school, or we're going to start a church, or we're going to start a business. Doesn't matter. Maybe we're going to start a fraternity. Or, I guess you wouldn't have me in a sorority, but, you know, we could start something. Nobody, no politics has the right to interfere with that. In other words, our agreement made of free will without fraud is the highest primary element of our society. and no vote. It doesn't matter if what we're doing is seen as inappropriate by the rest of the population for whatever reason. If we enter into it freely, no law can interfere with it. So we've never, whether it's the Magna Carta or the Declaration or even the U.S. Constitution, never has there been a stronger provision for the absolute protection of your property and of your right to associate with one another. This is extreme, and I personally love it, but yeah, it is radical. So you can imagine what the results of this would be, and I'm sure for those of you, and you guys get all of this if you haven't yet, but when you hear the history of the college, one of the main reasons that we remain free of federal interference is because when the federal government has tried to interfere with us, we have cited Article Number 2 of the Northwest Air Ordinance saying, look, we were chartered in 1844. We were anti-slavery before the U.S. government was. We were pro-black before the U.S. government was. We were pro-woman before the U.S. government was. Who are you coming afterwards to tell us when we're younger than you, since we're older than you, who are you to tell us what to do? This was all part of what we wanted to do. This is called the right to associate. And so we have that absolute right. And so far we've won. Yeah, that could change depending on who's in office. But so far we've been able to make that argument. But that argument is substantial, that we have the right, as long as there is no fraud, to do whatever we want in the protection of ourselves and our property. Article Number 3, and you can kind of laugh at some of this if you want, but I would also like us to think about what their intention was. First, religion, morality, and knowledge are necessary to good government and to happiness. But then jump down to the second part of that. The utmost good faith shall always be observed towards the Indians. Their lands and properties shall never be taken from them without their consent, or their property, their rights, and their liberty, they shall never be invaded or disturbed unless in just and lawful wars authorized by Congress. Now, we know this doesn't play out this way. But let's just imagine for a moment that these guys, and I think they are totally sincere, sitting there in Congress in New York in the summer of 1787, passing this unanimously. What do they think of American Indians? Again, forget the reality of what happens. What do they think of American Indians? What are they?
People.
Hannah?
People.
Absolutely. They're people. It's all that matters. It's the highest thing you can say about anyone. They're people. They have free will, they have dignity, and they have all the rights any other people anywhere in the world ever has or ever will have. They are completely 100% equal to us. And therefore, we can't invade them or disturb them. In the same way, I wouldn't walk into my neighbor's house and just walk out with his TV without his permission. Well, I can't walk into some guy's teepee and take out his buffalo skull. That's his. And I can't fight him for it. So this matters. And again, it's hypothetical, but I think it's honest. These guys truly believe the American Indians are Republicans. They are small R Republicans. They're primitive, and they have a while to go culturally to evolve. I'm sorry, I lost my voice yesterday. I can feel it's coming back. This is not emotion. This is but I'm not right now. So it's very important to recognize that they saw them as future citizens of the United States. It's going to take a while, but that future citizenship. Article 4 and 5, you don't have to know completely, but I do want you to know the essence of what they are. Article 4 and 5 are what we would call the anti-imperialist articles. And what they say is, anytime you step across the Ohio River, not only do you have your common law rights and your natural rights, but in matters of politics, you can never be considered a second-class citizen. So it's not as though the 13 colonies are all powerful and they radiate out. So Ohio, you're second class citizens, Kansans, you're third class, Californians, you're fourth class. Yet they learn from Rome, you can't do that. Every single territory and people that are brought into the United States will eventually gain pure equality with all others. And there's a step, you have to have 60,000 voters and so forth for this to happen. You have rules for it. But in essence, this is why Alaska and Hawaii ultimately became, not in my lifetime, but in my mother's lifetime, why they became states. And that's the same argument we could use for Puerto Rico. I mean, there are a lot of arguments that could go into this, but this was the argument. That is, we can never make a territory a second-class territory. Okay? And it's a great preventative for empire. But number six, you absolutely have to know. And here we have, and this is where Abraham Lincoln will get the entirety of his political philosophy, also backed by Aristotle and others, but this is the essence of republicanism. Now, big R, not just small R, big R republicanism, Lincolnianism, and his way of thinking, the whole Yankee way of thinking during the Civil War, there shall be neither slavery nor involuntary servitude in the said territory otherwise than in the punishment of crimes. So it doesn't go as far as it does with Indians. And with Indians, it's pretty clear that Indians are equal and they will become fully equal members of the American Republic. It doesn't say blacks will become fully equal members of the American Republic, but it definitely forbids slavery from existing in the territories. So the argument of the Americans, and especially people like Lincoln and the Republican Party, is that even though this only applies to the five states around the Great Lakes, Michigan, Illinois, Ohio, Indiana, Wisconsin, and just a little sliver of Minnesota, that even though it only by the letter of the law applies to that, the intent of the founders was to prevent slavery going into the territories. So when the Republican Party's founded by Ransom Dunn, first historian here at Hillsdale, just 30 miles north in that grove of oak trees, which is now unfortunately a Walmart, right there, when they found the Republican Party, the basis of the Republican Party is two things. One, we don't usually think about anymore, because Utah would be pretty ticked off. But number one, no slavery in the territories. Number two, the abolition of Mormonism. So those were the two main planks, right? We do conveniently forget that second one for obvious reasons. But the abolition of slavery in the territories, not allowing it to expand. So this is really a great Republican document and moment as, and why I hope you can see it was regarded as one of the four organic documents as well and equal to the others. Yeah.
How does the abolition of Mormonism work with the former article about, you know,
religion
being left alone?
Yeah, actually what they were trying to do was destroy polygamy within Mormonism. So it was really more polygamy that they were trying to get rid of. But because polygamy was so central to Mormonism at the time, it would have abolished the entire hierarchy. So yeah, that does seem a little contradictory. But they also, we can get into this later, I'm not sure how much we want to, but they definitely did not regard Mormonism as a legitimate religion. It was a cult, as most Americans, and actually most of the world. Have you ever read the first Sherlock Holmes story, Study in Scarlet? It all takes place with a series of murders in Utah. And it was very common to make the Mormons bad guys in the 19th century. So there's a lot behind that. Okay, good. All right, yeah, final question, please.
Were the founders' views on the Indians and slavery an anomaly among... Yeah, were they an anomaly, or was that kind of the general...
The Indians?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I think they had a pretty good sense of a common humanity. Not that they didn't have gradations and so forth, but I think that it was a pretty strong hint of where they were going and what they thought of, not only in terms of blacks, but also women later on. But it's not pure yet, right, by any means. It's going to take a while to get there. But yeah, I see it as a trajectory more than a permanent thing. Yeah. Okay, I will give you a study guide sometime between now and Friday, and we can talk about the midterm a little bit on Friday. I would ask you to read for Friday. Make sure you read the Constitution of the United States, and I would also like you to read the Bill of Rights and the Letters of Brutus. Okay? So Constitution, Bill of Rights, and the Letters of Brutus. Okay, good. Thanks, everybody. Have a great Wednesday and Thursday. Katie, did it come through?
I checked it.
Okay.
To remind you, I'll be your friend.